Welcome to I Do, I Sue, a family law podcast with Timothy Nichols and Gillian Yeend.
So, Gil, I'm really excited today. We've got a very special guest who's joining our podcast. It's someone that I actually have a long history with. It's someone that I've worked with previously when I was working in Sydney. This person is a lawyer that I have the utmost respect and admiration for. She's a brilliant family lawyer. But more than that, she's a brilliant person and I thoroughly enjoy her company. So we can add to that very big list of accolades that she's got. She's now also an author. So Without further ado, I'd like to introduce Bronna Lone to I Do, I Sue.
Well, thank you, Tim. That was quite the outstanding introduction. Thanks very much for having me, guys.
Hi, Bron. It's so exciting to talk to you today. And, you know, before we get started talking about your book, which I've read and I love, I just really wanted to explore with you the dirt on Tim and having worked with him. Can I say, I get the pleasure to work with him now. And sometimes I tell people that working with Tim's like playing with sparklers every day. Like,
that is perfect.
He's super fun. He lights up a room, but if you don't handle him carefully, he can singe your eyebrows. So I want the dirt on when you guys work together.
It sounds like you know him very well. That is a perfect description of Tim, of working with Tim. I love it. So look, let me just tell you this for a little bit of dirt. When Tim first came for an interview at the firm that he and I ended up working together at, I remember getting called in to the interview just for that, like the last bit of the interview. And I was like, wow, this guy's really, he's put together very well. And he spoke very eloquently and he was very impressive. And I asked him, I don't know if you remember this, Tim, but I asked you a question and I said,
I think I know what this is.
Do you like, you know, it's really important for us, you know, firm culture, et cetera. So, you know, what do you like to do for, you know, when you for social things, what do you like doing? And Tim surprisingly said, I don't really like going out very much. I don't really like going out. Maybe I'll go out for dinner, but I don't really enjoy that very much. That happened. This is real. I don't know if you remember that, Tim.
I was going through a phase then. I was trying to cut back on drinking and be a little bit more sensible and a little bit more athletic
and you were trying to impress us because you thought that we were all really conservative. So the next thing, Gil, I race upstairs after the interview and everyone's sitting around waiting to see what, you know, what's the new guy like? And
I said, open bottles of wine at that point. Like, yeah, what's the new guy like?
Yeah, you know? That's exactly what was happening. And I ran up and said, oh, it's not going to work. Because this guy just won't fit in the culture. He is not interested in coming out and playing with us at all. How wrong could I have been?
Can I say, how long did you manage to, like, keep that clever ruse up, Tim?
It's about 20 minutes.
Okay.
it was gone pretty quick, wasn't it? It was gone. I think you actually ended up coming upstairs that night.
And we had drinks, I think.
And had drinks.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So you didn't even last, like, one day. Like, you know, first glass of wine, it was over.
But luckily, and then so then Tim and I – then we headed up the social committee at work and doesn't that's just Tim all over, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think that sums us all up, doesn't it?
It does. It does. Yeah. So, you know, we had a wonderful time. We worked really, really hard together. We had really, really interesting matters and we worked very hard.
And but collaborated we had a together lot of well. Very good to bounce off stuff off and talk. And, you know, I think it's important when you're a lawyer dealing with cases and stuff, you've got to have people that you can talk to about this stuff.
It's so important, Tim. And it sounds like you and Gil do that a lot. You can just tell from the banter that you guys have on this podcast that you have this great ability to be able to bounce ideas off each other. And I think that's so important in our profession to have that.
Isn't it nice, like, seeing you guys? And, I mean, Tim and I had a similar experience in that we worked together, then we didn't work together and we worked together again. But, you know, family law is, you know, there's the same kind of people doing a lot of family law all the time. So it's really important to have, you know, positive and constructive relationships with people. But isn't it nice to, you know, work with someone, then not see them for a while and still know that you can have that trust and, you know, like ability to run things off each other, because it's a really hard job that we do.
And it's Absolutely. Getting more and more complex. The files aren't simple anymore. The work is complex.
That's exactly right. And Gil, just what you were saying then about being able to have, you know, those friendships moving forward as well is so important, I think, in the profession that yeah. we can, you know, we can contact each other even if we're not working in the same firm and have a discussion about what's going on and, you know, roll ideas around, because it's every matter's different and we all have our different views as well moving forward. So that's so helpful to have those colleagues. And something that I'm constantly saying to people at the moment is just try to practice empathy and be likable, be a nice person. You don't need to have that the fighting attitude constantly all the time. Actually try to enjoy your relationships with lawyers that you're dealing with, whether that be on the other side or if they're, you know, they're within your organisation as well.
I've said this before and I think that that's true. I think to be a good family lawyer, you have to be empathetic, not sympathetic. And I think Absolutely. That's, you can't, because a lot of people, I know there's that rumour that, you know, most family lawyers stay for about 5 years and then they move on because the issues and stuff. And we do deal with heavy issues. We deal with family violence and, you know, the trauma and things that people go through as the demise of their relationship unfolds. It's hard. It's really hard.
Yeah. And like one of the things that we recently talked to Dr. Catherine Boland about, which I thought was super interesting.
She was so interesting.
Oh, she's like, you just want to sit there and just listen for, you know, ever. Yeah. But she was talking about how it's really important that as part of a separation process and as part of helping our clients, we also role model good communication and good behaviours and good interactions. And you think that's really true? And, I mean, that's kind of our professional responsibility in navigating our clients through this pathway, is to not up the ante with the conflict and create fights, because they're already in massive conflict usually. And I thought that was a really interesting point to make.
I agree with you. I really liked that part of that podcast. I liked all of it, but that was very interesting. And I think lawyers forget that often. Yeah. And it's disappointing. And for our clients to see that going on, it's not helpful at all. We're in such high conflict environments. We need to take the heat out of the situation. It's up to us to do that.
Yeah, and can I say, Bron, in taking the heat out of the situation, so you have written a book called The Splits, How to Help Your Kids Navigate Separation and Divorce. And look, I might not be your target audience for this, but I have to say I loved reading it anyway. And it was great. And there was just so much in there that you think, oh, it's really good to reflect on this stuff as a practitioner, but also this is really constructive and practical stuff to give to clients. My first question about this is, like, what was the motivation to write this book? Like, where did this kind of come from?
Do you know what, Gil? And you guys would relate to this, I expect. I've spent so much time sounding like a broken record with my clients, where a client will come into me in relation to a parenting matter and say something. For example, I said to my kids that it's not my fault that that happened, it's his fault that that happened, things like that. And I felt like I was repeating myself, saying the same thing over and over again. And these are simple things that we know as family lawyers shouldn't be happening. They're conversations that our clients shouldn't be happening with their kids. Shouldn't be having with their kids, but to actually write it down and to have it as a resource for clients, I thought would be a really good idea to try and educate those people that are coming through the system as we call it. But it's really that's where it came from, where I thought it'd be helpful to be able to hand that information over rather than having to take clients through it myself. And especially, you know, not only for clients, but for anyone who's going through not even just separation, but any kind of conflict at home, how to actually think about communication and how that's going to impact your kids as you're moving through the conflict. Take, for example.
Yeah, and I mean, that was one of the, oh, sorry.
No, that's okay. I was just going to say, take, for example, you know, COVID lockdowns, where the three of us are all in lockdown at the moment, and it's hard at home. It's hard to, you know, work through things that are going on at home, and there's probably more conflict going on in people's homes, whether they're separated or not. So that was kind of the part of that book where I thought it would be helpful to be able to talk about those communication styles and what's important to people.
Yeah, and I mean, you write about being a broken record sometimes. Like, we all have the tools where we're like, you know, develop a business-like relationship, don't say these things. And there's some really practical stuff in your book, like, you know, like in terms of reframing communication styles for clients. And, you know, things like not referring to going to the other parents' houses visiting, you know, communication yeah. around I let them have the kids this weekend, whereas, you know, it's all this kind of possessive communication styles that, you know, we really need to weed out. And it's nice having it all in one place to kind of read through and to be able to say to a client, look, maybe have a read of this and look and see, are you doing any of these things in terms of your you know, co-parenting post-separation relationship, and is there any of this stuff that you can work on?
That's right, Gil, and it's about being able to give people that opportunity to reflect on their behaviour in it. Hopefully there's a lot of stuff in the book that people wouldn't be doing or wouldn't need to reflect on, but it's still helpful to take that time to think back and go through it. I'm just, you know, I'm reminding myself of things in the book, like there's a chapter that I've called Avoiding Common Communication Pitfalls, and things like your kid is not your spy.
Mm, you know, yeah.
We've all had that situation, haven't we, in a family law matter where that happens, where, you know, a child's asked to go and find out what's going on at mummy's house or what's happening over there at the other place. And these are things that I think our clients, they think they're doing the right thing. And it's coming from a good place. They're trying to work through their, you know, to process what's going on. But to be able to read through something like this and to realize that perhaps that's not a good thing to be doing, can give them a, you know, get them to step back and look at the bigger picture and how that's actually impacting their kids, right? Like, it's because it's a big deal. Yeah, and then
in that chapter you also have things like your kid's not your carrier pigeon, which is also true, you know, putting the notes in the back of the bag, like tell your mother there's a note for her in there or whatever. And you think, just such a pressured situation for kids to have to navigate and manage, but it's like, it's good, it's really accessible information about this stuff and why it's problematic developmentally for kids going through this process.
And what I like about this is it's not critical. It's an observation. It's a reflection. It's not saying, you know, this is the way it needs to be or this is, you know, bad behavior. It's about how can we improve? What can we do better? There's no criticism involved in that.
Yeah, you know, that was actually hard, Tim, to not be critical. It actually was. So when I started to prepare for the book, I followed a really strict process with myself because, like all of us, I'm pretty time poor. So I needed to be very strict with how I was going to make this book happen. And the first thing I did was that I scaffolded out the chapters. And when I first did that, I did step back and think, oh, this is borderline. This could really come off as being quite a critical text. And that's not the vibe that I'm going for at all. So it actually took me a lot of time to reflect on that and to go back and to try to write it in a way that it wasn't critical, as you say, that it was more of a how-to and to be a helpful text.
I also think that comes back to us as lawyers and stuff and the way that we communicate as well, to think about not being critical of our clients and not being critical of the decisions and stuff that they make. Dr. Boland made a comment, and it's a phrase that I use multiple times a day now. She calls, when someone does something that's less than ideal, she calls it a suboptimal moment.
I love that.
And I love that phrase because, A, there's no criticism involved in that. It's just the recognition that that behaviour could have been done better. And I think that was my takeaway from your book, is that it's a process of evaluation and thinking, how, you know, we're at point B, how do we get to point A? What tools can we use? How can we improve, you know? And I think
that's
phenomenal and a great resource for clients.
That's right, Tim. And having that, the ability to be able to self-reflect, is so important. So you know, tools like this book, I think can help our clients to walk that pathway of self-reflection. And even if they get one thing out of it, I think it's, you know, it's helpful for them to sit back and say, well, what am I actually doing at the moment through my separation journey that might be impacting my kids in a negative way? And what can I do better moving forward to help them? So hopefully it will help us family lawyers in managing the separation journey as well for our clients.
It's reframing the discussion too, because I think you would agree that, and Gil and I have spoken about this before, is that when you have a client and you recommend resources to them, there's sometimes a wall that comes up, and it's like, well, I don't need that. My parenting is excellent,
or yes,
the way I do things at home is the best way. And
you think, absolutely,
you could be doing things that are absolutely great, but there's all, you know, I say this as well in my practice of law. The day I stop learning something or developing in my practice as a lawyer is the day I hand in my certificate. I don't want to be, you know, you're never going to be at the point where you know everything and you think these resources are actually fantastic tools.
Can I say, if you do that though, Tim, I'll be like, sorry, you can't. We've got too much work to do. Back in your office, put the certificate back up on your wall. Like,
that's all right. You can handle my extra 60 files, Gil. You can handle it.
Right. 60 files, you're working too hard.
It's what we love, right? It's what we love. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. Exactly. I think that, look, basically the book, it's a, for me, or I know for my clients, it's been an opportunity for me to be able to just to give them something to say, just have a think about this. But I know, I hear what you're saying, Tim. It can be hard. People can put a wall up, can't they, and say, don't tell me what to do. I don't want to know about it. So it's got to be that softly, softly approach, I think, with people.
But that's the phrase you just said, have a think about this, Bron. You know, that is a suggestion that is not imbued with any criticism or anything. It's a, you know, have a think. It's easy.
That's right. You know, do you know what? This has been really interesting for me. Some of the feedback that I've gotten from the book has been from people who are grandparents or aunts or uncles, yeah, of people who are going through separation. And, you know, there have been people who have been concerned about what's going on in the family unit and have picked up my book and read it and contacted me and said, this makes things a lot clearer for me as a third party out of the actual conflict, but seeing what's going on and trying to understand why my son or my daughter are behaving in this way. So that's been a really interesting bit of feedback from the book as well.
And imagine if that can, I guess, assist or improve the process, because who hasn't had the experience where, you know, you're trying to work with a client in the context of us knowing what the process looks like and what the kind of tips and traps are, but having clients come along and saying, yeah, that's all great, but I've spoken to this person and I've spoken to this person and I want to, you know, go full ball in this way or whatever, and you know that it's not a great path and it's not going to get them the most optimum outcomes for the process, but having a resource that you can kind of spread around as well is kind of a really nice idea to kind of provide support to those around someone going through a process other than just their lawyer.
Yeah, I was surprised by the feedback, but yeah, it makes sense, doesn't it, that people want to, you know, they're caring for their families and they want to know what's going on. There's another chapter in the book where I talk about, I don't know if you remember it, Gil, about going to court and the fact that it's, you know, it's a big, long, can be expensive process and you really don't want to go there. Part of my practice is very much focusing on an amicable pathway. So I've tried to put that into the book as well, but there's a reality, don't we know, that for some matters, unfortunately, even though people want to work in a collaborative or amicable way, it's impossible and people end up in court. But I just raise that because it's interesting, you know, like the book, I talk about going to court and now we've got the merger happening. I'm going to have to do an update.
It's a brand new world. Oh, we haven't even seen the new harmonised rules yet. And
it's so interesting, isn't it?
We have a new court and all new forms apparently as well. It's going to be a very, very steep change in the way that we practice.
Yeah. Well, I hope that it's going to be a really big change to the way we practice. That's my hope, that the change is going to be a big one we all need a bit of a shake up to be able to move forward. And if it's right that we can start to move matters through within that 12-month timeframe, then wow, I mean, amazing if that could happen.
Well, I think that's what I think about with your book and the resources there about communication. And like we've spoken before on the podcast about people becoming positional in proceeding,
yes,
and digging their heels in and so on and so forth. You think, well, the way in which, and you see contravention of orders, like there was the practice directional that came out of the court yesterday in relation to the new national contravention list.
So
yes, they're going to be, you know, expeditiously dealing with people who have very little regard for court orders. I think that's fantastic. I think, you know, and I think thinking about what the book does and how that can help is, you know, the process is the process and you need to communicate better and engage better and think about, you know, what the consequences are.
That's right. And Tim, you said it right. The process is the process. So if our clients unfortunately find themselves in that process, what I've tried to do in this book is to try to just set it out clearly for them that it is a process and that they need to make sure they've got a good family lawyer and they need to listen to that person. They need to really listen to them to understand the best way for them to get through that process, because we're the people who can help them to do that.
And I say this to clients frequently, it's, you know, in to get through the process efficiently and expeditiously is the goal, because you think about, you know, the 10 or 15 grand on legal fees by, you know, being obtuse, being positional, doing all of that, that's a year of private school fees for your children. That's a wonderful holiday for you to take your kids away once all of this is settled, you know.
That's right.
There has to be a little bit of reality testing on the apportionment. I mean, we're not all made of money. Not everybody can afford to, you know, to take a matter to final hearing and do all of that. But getting positional and having that attitude towards the engagement is it's the cost-benefit analysis, isn't it? You think, what is this actually worth?
Yep, that's right.
No, that's good. And I mean, you know, one of the other things, and this is kind of moving away from the process, but coming back to another chapter in your book and, you know, us having the same things we say to clients all the time, one of the things I often say to clients is, you know, the biggest gift you can give your kids out of this process is not exposing them to the conflict, you know, and allowing them to be kids and grow up, not having really been exposed to this is how mum and dad really felt in this process. But you have a chapter in your book and I loved it because it was just so optimistic. And, you know, as Tim would probably tell you, like, I'm all about the optimism in our job. But you talked about resilience and a byproduct of a good family law process, if we can call it that, being like allowing your kids to develop some greater resilience that they can use in life in general, like in workplaces and with other relationships and stuff. And you did some research into what resilience means, which was fascinating. But do you want to tell us a bit about that? Because I just loved that bit in your book.
Yeah, I really enjoyed writing that part of the book because it was the silver lining of separation and what can actually come of it. What are the good things? Because there are good things. And yet, I say in the book that resilience needs to be your new favorite word, because kids become resilient through this process. And that is the silver lining of the separation process in my mind. I did a lot of research, Gil, and worked through and came up with these six traits that I think actually equal resilience.
Yeah, and that was amazing. Like, it was great to have that broken down in that way.
Yeah, it was really good to go through it because what I did was I worked through these six traits and then I talk about how that how it impacts your children and what kind of things can you do to help to develop those six traits in your children. So the traits of courage, gratitude, empathy, not sympathy. We have to remember that empathy is different. Self-awareness, responsibility, and then my favorite one, self-care.
Can I say in your self-care list, and I think it's like number 10, and it's on, I've made some notes, so it's on page 201. That probably doesn't apply to Tim, but I was with you with that. I thought that was great. and people will have to get the book and, you know, reference that.
But people have to reference that one.
Yeah, I know. I don't know if it's good for, you know, on the podcast, but I thought those, like, you know, again, kind of looking for the positives in this process. You know, when you break up resilience in that way, you think that's quite true. And people who are skilled in all of those things, you would kind of reflect on and say they're really resilient people. So it was great.
Yeah. And I think it's something, it gives people something positive to focus on so that they can look at that and say, well, these are the skills that my kids can actually come out of this process with, because like it or not, the kids are involved.
Yeah.
They're a part of it. You know, kids that are a lot younger, they're not going to really know what's going on, but they certainly sense it. But older children and teenagers, they know exactly what's going on in a separation, whether you want them to or not. They've got ears like an elephant. You can walk into a room and kids will be able to read what's on your face. And
smart.
To be able to then say, yeah, that's right. And then to be able to say, well, you know what? These things are actually going to become positives for your kids. It's okay. They're going to be okay moving forward.
And it's such a, like, reading that, I just thought, this is great. Like, again, I think I've said to you before, there's lots of things in your book that I'm just going to take and go, right, I'm going to use this with clients. Like, one of the other things was your resource list for books, for kids' books to read.
I had so much fun going through that.
One about, like, was it the chocolate pudding, which I've read before, which is a great, it's such a beautiful book about this process. But, coming back to the list of resilient kind of components and what your kids can get out of it, you think that is a really positive set of things to be able to say to a client and say, if we do this the right way and if we can keep this on track as much as it can be and minimize the conflict in getting to an outcome, these could be the additional things that your kids come out with in a positive way, and it's great.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was a joy to write that part of the book because it was that opportunity to say these are all the good things that will come out of this. Apart from the fact that also you're able to move on with your life if you're going through a separation and you can find your new way moving forward, so can your kids. So no, it was a joy to write that part of the book. It really was. I'm just looking through it now as we're talking, Gil, and one of my favourite bits in it was, you know, not many words on the page at all, but the 10 ways to help future-proof your kids after separation.
Oh, no, that's good too. Yeah.
I was actually going to call the book that, how to future-proof your kids after separation, but I wanted to focus, I changed the title because I wanted to focus more on the process during separation and not all about being afterwards. But I really like those 10 ways to future-proof your kids, because I think it's a really good checklist for people to have a look at and just keep those basics in their mind. So things like helping your kids feel at home, wherever home is. There's a chapter in the book about that. You know, home is where, you know, that whole, the whole idea of home is where the heart is. It's true. It doesn't matter where they are. As long as they're with the parent, with their parents that they love, then they're going to feel at home. You know, do what you promise to do.
That's actually one of the most important things for securing an attachment with a child.
Yeah.
It's about maintaining and meeting expectations.
Mm.
And I've read that in the book and I was like, that is one of the biggest humdingers in my mind in terms of co-parenting after separation. You know, if the arrangement's going to be, you know, dinner on a Tuesday and every second weekend, you show up on time because you want your kids to know that's going to, when they're going to have the golden time with dad or mum, you know, that's
really. Yeah, that's right. It's about keeping that trust, isn't it? And honesty with the kids so that they know what's happening. You know, we all know this, that kids need to have, they want stability and they need to be able to have a routine to be able to work towards. So, you know, that's something that I guess as family lawyers, we're striving for, to help families to reach some kind of a routine that works for that family. That kind of stems back to that. And that actually, it brings me to another thing that I mentioned in the book, that I do a bit of parenting coordination work. I've actually just started with that part of my practice. And that's all about helping with that routine and being able to help to go through that process. It's a new kind of thing that's coming out in family law circles at the moment. Have you guys heard of it?
Yeah, so I've heard about it briefly, Bron, but it's actually on my list of things to ask you, which I hadn't gotten to yet, so that's good. Because, you know, in your book and I think on other stuff, it says that you are a parenting coordinator. And you think, I really want someone to unpack what that means for me, because I think it's a really interesting concept and additional tool to have in this whole process.
Yeah, no, it is. It's something that I actually stumbled across last year, where I worked with a parenting coordinator in a really high conflict parenting matter. And the parenting coordinator was based in Brisbane. And I didn't really know that we did very much of that kind of work in New South Wales at the time. So it all unfolded in Brisbane, and I became aware of it then and thought, wow, this is really interesting process that can actually help in high conflict situations. So look, essentially it's, you know, as family lawyers, how we deal with families involved in the court process all the time.
Yep.
And you can imagine that by the time orders are made, not only are our clients, you know, emotionally and financially fatigued by the whole process, but often the conflict is so entrenched that there's no relationship left. Even if there was one to start with, there's nothing left in that relationship. So we're sending our clients off with a set of orders or a parenting plan and saying, now you've got to just make that work in some way. Yeah. So, you know, you can imagine how hard it can be for people to be able to move forward and implement those orders. And you can imagine how hard it is to know what to do if you're a client, if, for example, something's missing in the orders. Because we're all good family lawyers, but sometimes we do miss out on some things.
But also, even if they've been imposed by a court, Bron, you know, you think...
Exactly.
And you're absolutely right. Like, one of the things I'm always really conscious about in this process is, you know, letting clients know that it's great that you've got lawyers and we're writing letters to each other and communicating on your behalf, but at the end of this process, you will either have to go back to communicating with one another in some way, and we should work out your best way of doing that now, or you're just going to be back getting lawyers to write more letters at the end of the process, which is awful.
That's right.
But, you know, I can see that there are some matters where even if you're, you know, working through those processes during the matter, by the time you get to the end of a matter, they probably still need some additional assistance to keep stuff on track.
That's right. And that's where parenting coordination comes in. It's essentially, if I can just summarize it, it's a case management solution, and it's designed to support parents to implement and comply with court orders or a parenting plan. But here's the thing, and this is what I think, this is the really important part of the message. When I first got involved with parenting coordination, I thought it was all about when final orders are made and how we're going to support parents moving forward to stop contravention applications and to help people to be able to work through the little issues that come up or the bigger issues that come up as well. But it's not the case. That parenting coordination can come in at any stage. And one of the really good stages for a parenting coordinator to be appointed is when that first lot of interim orders is made. You know that time in a matter where you've got interim orders?
It's the new dynamic.
That's it. You go into the pool awaiting final hearing dates, and your client, they're stuck in this process where no one's really happy and everyone's treading water.
Yeah.
That's where this case management comes into play. This is the perfect situation for it.
And just, again, because this is fascinating stuff, Bron, but in terms of how practically a parenting coordinator would work, so, you know, just say parties say, okay, we're going to engage one, is that parenting coordinator then able to freely communicate with both parties? What kind of information do they give back to the parties, or how does that all work in terms of coordinating that?
So one of the big things to understand is that parenting coordination is reportable. And we really, to work as a parenting coordinator, you're taking your lawyer hat off to become a parenting coordinator. And when I did the training with two really wonderful women. I don't know if you know them, Gil and Tim. Their names are Dr. Anne Purcell and Cassandra Poulos.
Yes.
Yep.
They're just the course is amazing, and you know they take you through all of the processes and different things. But very much so, the people who were on the course with me were not just family lawyers; they were psychologists as well. Lots of social workers, different people. So we were all bringing our different strengths into the role to be able to work that way. So in saying all of that, a parenting coordinator who has a background like me as a family lawyer is going to run things a little bit differently to, say, a psychologist who has been appointed as a parenting coordinator. And let me say, in relation to appointments, parties can either choose to enter into that together, but often the court will actually appoint a parenting coordinator as well. And it's something that more family report writers are starting to put into their reports as well, that they're recommending that a parenting coordinator be appointed to this matter, to a certain matter. And how it works is that you meet, it's almost like a mediation intake session. You meet with each of the mum and the dad, or the parents, I should say, separately, and then you bring them together to have sessions with them. And it's about helping them with their day-to-day obligations of the orders, the interim orders or the final orders or the parenting plan. So helping them with those things that come up, helping them to resolve any gaps or any misunderstandings. So where normally they would go back to their lawyer to do that, they're coming together collaboratively to sit with a parenting coordinator to work on those issues. Another part of the role is educative. That's a big part of it. To have in our toolbox things that we can teach these people to help them to communicate. Because guess what? They got to communicate. If they're in parenting orders together, there's got to be some form of communication. We can educate them about the tools that they can use. Some of the things I've got in my book about, different apps and things, and we've all tried different things out. Yeah. Some are good, some are not so good. Depends on the clients, right? Depends on what works for them. So parenting coordinator works through that and tries to help parents to reach some form of a communication that's going to help them moving forward. The whole goal is to stop them from having to go back to court for a contravention application, or to go back to their lawyer to, have it out with the other side about a small issue that can be resolved between them with a bit of guidance.
You know what's fascinating about this, Bron, is, and again, Tim and I always talk about how our job is, a lot of problem solving, like in a really practical way.
Yeah, right.
And, parenting coordinators, I would have to say, it's not a super popular thing yet, but you can certainly see that it sounds like it's come out of, it's a byproduct of people working in our jurisdiction having to be really creative about what are new ways to start solving these problems. And it's just really interesting that, I think sometimes the family law system and family lawyers can get a bit of a bad rap in the media and so forth, but people are, I think, genuinely really motivated to try and help people have better outcomes in this kind of process.
And I think, Gil, that's right. And it's about, it's a holistic approach. So as lawyers, as family lawyers, we have that role to play where we're advising our clients and we're helping them to come up with a strategy to move forward in their matter, and to hopefully reach agreement, but otherwise to get them to the end of that matter with some orders that are going to work moving forward. And I'm talking here not just about parenting matters, of course, but property matters as well. But the holistic side of things with the parenting aspects of matters is that sometimes or often there's a need for some extra support. So, you know how you can find, in some matters or a lot of my matters where I will involve family therapy, psychologists are involved. It's that kind of a idea with parenting coordination, but it's more of an education stand as well, where we're helping your client to get from, for example, an interim order stage to keep the wheels on turning on the bus, basically, so we don't lose everything, that we can start to try and build some communication moving forward and to help with those smaller issues. Importantly, parenting coordination, when I've got that hat on, I'm not advising anybody. It's not a legal advisory role at all. So it's a different role. It's a support role to support the family lawyer who's involved in that matter.
But yeah, having a deep understanding.
We can go back and make a big list, Tim, of all the matters we need to get parenting
coordinators. There are many. But yeah. Also, wouldn't that assist you, though, having your legal knowledge and your practice as a lawyer to be able to obviously understand the orders, understand the intention of the orders, why they were done the way they were done, to be able to give that feedback to the parties so that they can say, oh, I understand that now, you know?
It's interesting you raise that, Tim, because when I did the training, we spent a lot of time talking about that and the fact that, you know, as family lawyers, we've got this great background to be able to understand the orders and to help explain what the orders mean without giving advice. And there's a fine line there, right? You've got to, you know, make sure that you're wearing your right hat. But then there were, as I said earlier, psychologists and social workers who are also on the course who we spoke about how they don't have that legal background to help them be a parenting coordinator, but they bring those other skills into play. So the idea, you know, they're fantastic with teaching about different ways to communicate and to resolve issues through communication and listening and understanding and those kinds of things. So it really depends on what the matter is and the type of parenting coordinator and the type of background that you need for a matter. When I spoke before about the matter that I had last year where a parenting coordinator was appointed, that parenting coordinator had a social science background, and that was needed. That was perfect for that matter because there were a lot of communication issues between the parties. The orders were quite simple otherwise. So it fit. Just like when we have to make a decision about who would be an appropriate expert to be appointed, it's a similar situation with parenting coordination.
Yeah, and you can see that, for example, you know, you might, if you've got a matter where you've got a really young child and parties are grappling with, you know, I want to move to overnight time or more time and this doesn't seem fair, you might need someone with, you know, a therapeutic background who can explain the developmental needs of the child at that time and help work through those issues.
That's it. That's right.
Yeah, so that's really interesting as to how you pick, you know, the right coordinator for the right matter.
Yeah, so it's still a fairly new process. It's been happening for a while in Queensland, but it's fairly new down in New South Wales and Victoria, and there's some other states that I don't think they've only got one or two parenting coordinators available at this stage. So it's definitely new and it's progressing. But it's something that, yeah, I think everyone should have a think about and keep an eye out for, to consider moving forward and having in, as a family lawyer, having it as a tool in your toolbox for those high conflict matters. I know with work that I do, my ICL work, gee whiz, like a lot of those matters it'd be extremely helpful to have a parenting coordinator on board. And, you know, think about matters where there's a self-represented litigant, which makes it very difficult. Having a parenting coordinator on board can really assist with that process as well.
I have a question, Bron. So you said before a parenting coordinator can be appointed between the parties, or the court can actually appoint a parenting coordinator. In those circumstances where the court does that, are the orders such that, you know, within 7 days the father will propose three, and within a further 7 days the other party will nominate who they accept to be the parenting coordinator? Or does the court actually nominate? How does that process work in a litigation context if the judge is making an order or making a determination that this is something a matter requires?
Yeah, it's a good question, Tim. So from my experience, when I was involved with a parenting coordinator last year in Brisbane, we had an order where one party proposed three and then the other party, so just as you would with evaluation or something like that. But there are other matters that I have I've been told through my colleagues that whether his honour or her honour has provided the name of a parenting coordinator and actually just said, that's who we're going to appoint. So it really it depends on the situation. It's similar to an expert writing report. It's a similar process.
It's interesting
there,
though, and I like this process, because if you think of a party going through an interim hearing or a final hearing to receive the benefit of orders because they can't make an agreement, the statistics are quite troubling with compliance with orders that are forced upon parties as opposed to reaching agreement between themselves. Parties Absolutely. Are much more likely to comply with orders if they have had some input or some ownership yeah. in that process. So you think there are those matters, as we've discussed today, that need a final hearing. The parties just are unable to resolve their dispute. A parenting coordinator can assist in the management and compliance with those orders moving forward. I think that's a fantastic thing.
That's it, Tim. You've hit the nail on the head. And those matters that do go to a final hearing where the judge is making the final determination and both parents walk out of there feeling that neither of them got what they wanted, you know, that's a really tough, can you imagine like being in that position where it's a really tough decision, or not decision, but a position to be in where you've got to follow these orders that a judge has made for you. And, you know, there are situations where a parenting coordinator will be appointed by a judge at a final hearing where the parties need to attend upon a parenting coordinator for a period of 12 months or a period of 2 years. And that the court is able to put that into place to be able to essentially shore up those orders to get people through that. I mean, it's not really a honeymoon period, but you know what I mean. It's like the opposite. What's the opposite of a honeymoon yeah. period? But that, you know, that once a final order is made, to try to get parties over that initial hump of getting, you know, moving into the process and trying to figure out what the pressure points are going to be for those orders. For example, you know, yes. like a judge has made an order for the kids to go and spend Christmas with that parent this year. Hang on a minute, that's not going to work out for either of us. Both parents aren't happy about it, but they don't know what to do. They don't know what to do about that. That's where it kind of comes into play.
And that's interesting, like from the perspective of when you get orders from a judge at the end of a hearing, sometimes what people don't understand is the judge isn't going to put all the bells and whistles in that you might otherwise have in some consent orders. So, you know, when you're working with clients, you know, I often say, look, because, you know, sometimes people say to you, just let the judge decide. And you think, well, that is easier than actually having to knuckle down and work this stuff out. But if you sit down and work this stuff out, you can actually have some input into this stuff and add in the things that are particular to your scenario. But if a judge, after hearing a case and getting frustrated with everyone and whatever, makes orders, they'll just be, here's the orders, no bells and whistles, kind of applicable to your circumstances, but probably not in the most optimum way. And you can see that it's those kinds of orders that often come unstuck because people go, well, the judge didn't comment on X, and we, you know, we need this. And you think, well, yeah, because you went to a trial and that's what happens. So it'd be good to have a parenting coordinator there to kind of work through those issues.
That's it, Gil. And imagine that, you know, that same client coming back to you otherwise and saying, yeah. well, this isn't working out. Now what? You know, and they're entering back into that process.
Yeah. A parenting coordinator can facilitate that process because a lot of people don't realise it can vary a final parenting order by a parenting plan.
So in that situation,
that need to be clarified, the parenting yeah. coordinator, and hopefully that process will assist them to improve their communication so yeah. they can actually mean, you know, you say this particular thing doesn't work for us, let's vary it, let's look at what that looks like.
That's it. And so, Tim, in that, that's a really good example. In that sort of an example, parenting coordinator's role would be to say, okay, well, this is a possibility, you can do this. This is available to you to vary the orders if that's what you guys agree on. I'm going to send you back to your solicitors now for that to occur. And the parenting coordinator steps out of that situation at that point because that's the legal hat that they're wearing then. And we're not to do that with parenting coordination.
Yeah, this is, can I say, Bron, having written down Ask Bron what a parenting coordinator is, I didn't think I'd get so much information. Like,
this is amazing.
Book's super progressive, but this is so progressive as well and exciting. I feel like once lockdown's over, we need to go and have some champagne. Tim yes. will join us, but he probably won't drink because remember what he told you.
Oh, that's right.
At the start. yeah, you know, we can go and have a good time. But it's been so good to chat to you about this stuff. Don't you agree, Tim?
I agree. But the question I have and I want to for everybody, this book is an amazing resource. And Gil and I have
thanks,
both read
Tim.
It. We think it's fantastic.
And thank you. That means a lot.
singing your praises to everybody. How can people get a copy of it?
Thank you.
Good question, Tim.
Okay. Well, that's a good question. It's available. It's actually available at a lot of places. It's on Amazon.
Bernie told me you were perhaps the number one on Amazon.
Wow, that's amazing, bro.
Tell us, Brian,
yeah, it became a number one bestseller in a couple of different categories. I don't think it stays there for very long, though.
It's but, amazing.
It did reach number one status. I think last time I checked, it was still number one in the divorce section, which, you know, Ooh. Makes sense that it would be that in that section. So it's available on Amazon as an ebook, or you can buy a hard copy. People are telling me that it's taking a bit of time because did you know that Amazon, they print on demand? How crazy is that?
Yeah, I didn't know that either.
It's so crazy. So if you buy it on Amazon and you want a hard copy, you're going to be waiting a little while. It's available on Booktopia, on Barnes & Noble, Angus & Robertson. You can pick up a copy at the National Library, apparently.
Wow.
Or you can go to my website to get a copy. That's probably the quickest way to do it because my little person in my office can send it out to you by post. And that website is bronolone.com.
I think that's how we got our copies too.
It is.
Like, you know, can I say I have a hard copy? It's also a super cute book because I'm all about how do I decorate with the books, especially, sometimes I don't read them and I decorate with them. I did read this one, but, yes, great. I worked in a bookstore at uni, so, like, I'm all about making the books, you know.
Well, tell me, what do you think of the cover? Because I'd like your opinion.
It's super cute.
Like it?
I really like it. And it's bright and, like, you know, like certainly if you were displaying it in a bookstore, it'd stand out and be, you know, commercially appropriate. So
I was so
cute. A little speech bubble from the girl being like, my parents read this book and they're communicating effectively. And I'm happy.
That's a great idea. I had all of these visions of, you know, going to the bookshop and finding it and then sneaking into the bookshop and like pulling it out of the bookshelf and putting it somewhere really obvious and then running out of the bookshop. But of course, COVID stopped all of those plans because I can't get into a bookshop. So I'll have to wait.
But you are at the front. You're number one on Amazon.
That's right. Yeah. That's exactly right.
Oh, and thank you so much.
Like, we're your number one fans on this podcast. So like that counts for something too.
Oh, thanks, Gil. What I'd really love if you guys could send me a picture of a photo of yourselves holding the book, I'd love that. And then
100%. Look,
thank absolutely. You. I'm gonna start a fan wall.
Yeah. Asking Tim to take a photo of himself is really a hard challenge.
You'll do it for me, Timmy, won't you?
I will 100% do that for you, Bronnie. Yeah.
All right. Well, stay safe in lockdown, Bron. Like, this has been really fun.
Thank you so much for your time. I know you're super busy, so thank you so much for meeting with us today.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it, guys. It was lots of fun.
Okay, bye.
See you guys.
Bye.
You've been listening to I Do, I Sue, a family law podcast with Timothy Nichols and Gillian Yeend. To find out more about your hosts and what they do, visit chamberlains.com.au. And now, here's the bit the boss insisted we say. The information in this podcast is for general educational purposes only. None of the content should be considered legal advice. Please don't make decisions based on the information in this podcast without seeking professional legal advice of your own. For more information, visit chamberlains.com.au.